first question was one of where in the world is God calling me to serve? The next question was, what does it mean to be faithful in that context? And that's the question that we're going to go after this morning. How do you get a handle on what it means to be faithful? Obviously, we're not beginners at this. We've all struggled with it in many different parts of our lives. So what I'm going to throw at you today is two or three different models that you may find useful. One of them has to do with the word caring. Think of caring, and we think of the interpersonal kinds of caring that we have been involved in, and those are very important in any ministry that we carry out, in any form of service. We think of reaching out a hand when somebody is upset. We think of being a good listening ear. There are many forms of what it means to be caring, what it means to be loving. And what we're going to put up here are nine different types of caring, just to break open that word and use it in perhaps a more expansive way than it might normally be used. For example, if you consider yourself to be a manager of gifts, a person who stewards the gifts of others. You don't necessarily have to be a manager in a situation, and I noticed some of you were taking notes. I have copies of this, so I'll pass them out. You may still take notes, but you have to copy the whole wheel down. Whatever situation you're in, there are people in that situation who have gifts. And if you are aware of those different gifts and are part of bringing those gifts out, seeing to it that those gifts are being used in a constructive way, you are a manager of gifts, whether or not you're in a leadership position or not. So if you're in a family and you're seeing that all the people in the family, you're making an effort that all the people in the family are using their gifts, that's managing gifts. If you're in a workplace, the same thing. Now, let's go back to the center for a minute. Embodying personally and institutionally compassion for the whole of God's created order. What about institutionally? Well, I would say that there are some companies that do a better job at using the gifts of the people in that company than other companies. So that your task in this case might not only be to see to it that the people in your immediate surroundings are using their gifts, but to have an influence on the policy of the larger institution to see that that is set up so that people use their gifts. So that might have something to do with how people can move from one position to another in the organization. Again, you don't have to be at the top to be having an influence on that. You could be a member of a union, and the union could be promoting a policy that allows people to make better use of their gifts. You could be a member of top management, you could be a member of middle management, you could be anywhere in the organization to have an influence on this. Okay, let's zip around to some of the other ones. Building. The creation of community, community that serves other people, can happen in many different situations. From last night's stories, when Tom was talking about the area of Tacoma and I don't know all the other cities there, but in a sense you're trying to create a community, a bigger community there that serves the world perhaps in a little better way than you see it serving right now. So you're working on issues of employment and what we do for to earn income in that whole area and trying to shift that a little bit. But also the building of community happens in a smaller kind of way, where you're in an organization, Sixth Sense, and how do you work, how do you build a community of people there that can work together? So that could be a purpose that you have. These are, in a sense, purposes. They're also could be looked at as methods of ministry. If you think of ministry as service, what is your purpose? You might have an objective that has to do with peace in the world, in your case. How are you going to get there? Well, the building of community within the organization Sixth Sense and also within the larger geographical area are two of the methods by which you'll get there. Modeling. We model all the time. Whatever we do sets an example, either positively or negatively. Hopefully we're modeling in good ways. That can mean, whenever you set an example for people in a by what you do, you are modeling. Whenever you refrain from doing something, if people are engaged in some kind of put-downs and you do not engage in that, you're modeling someone who refrains from that. So that's another way we can express our caring. Hosting can be used in the typical sense of someone who is hosting a party, someone's hosting a dinner. Can also be used in other situations, such as when I was teaching sociology a couple of years ago and we had some discussion on child abuse, and I would bring in, a speaker came in on child abuse, and then after that students had an opportunity to choose, among other topics, to choose writing about their own childhood. And I was, in a sense, hosting. I was creating an environment in which they could explore and be nurtured and explore some of the hurts of their lives. So I was being a host in that situation, even though you thought, a lot of people look at me and say, you're a teacher. And you look up to this other part up here and say, I was being a teacher. But I was being a host. In fact, my contention is that we do all of these. Some of them may be more of our focus than others. Celebrating. It says here to affirm God's actions in our world. Well, it can be a direct celebration of using God language, but also a lot of the celebration we do, a lot of the work we do out in the world will not be using God language, but will be using the love and all the values of our faith. And celebrations can be one of those. So there's a way that, for example, even something like having people's birthdays celebrated in a small department is a way of celebrating. Or if somebody is able to do something, somebody who procrastinates is able to do something well on time, and you're able to celebrate with them the change. Teaching is not just done by teachers, but is done by everybody. We all have information that others don't have. How do we convey that information so that others can make use of it? It may be a parent with a child. It may be information that we are working on, some research information. So we are all teachers. Critiquing and envisioning often go hand in hand. The critiquing Some people, some Christians, hesitate to see that as part of Christianity. They have this, what I would call, culturally limited view of Christianity, that you smile and you're nice, which is also a very important value of Christianity. But there are times to be critical. There are loving ways to be critical. We sometimes forget that. Clearly, last night we're talking about people who are in situations where there are things wrong and something has to be done about it. So how do you go about that work of critiquing? One way is to have a sense of vision. What is might God's vision for your particular workplace be? And for you in that workplace and for others in that workplace. Envisioning can be something that you do for a institution, or it can be something you do for a person. If I, at another point in my life, I taught math, and I worked with a student who, this would happen more than once, I'm just giving a general kind of example, worked with a student, for example, who had trouble with word problems and had no confidence. Well, if I was able to believe that this person had the ability to do it, I was envisioning success for them to get through this. That made a huge difference because they did not have that for themselves. They had a minuscule amount, so I had to build on that. Perhaps one of the other ways I would do that would be to celebrate if they did a word problem and they only got one out of five steps right. Instead of helping them to focus on the four that they got wrong and feeling overwhelmed, I helped them to build on the one they got right and really recognize that and see if they could move from there to the next step. So these are methods you can use individually and institutionally. Making and distributing. When we provide, we are making. Of course, there are questions about how to do that. Let me give an example from a workshop I did recently with a person who's a truck driver who delivers milk, who doesn't basically feel very good about his job compared to other people in his congregation who are professionals. And so he's picked up the attitude of this society that some jobs have better esteem than others. But to look at his job of providing for something that we humans need allows for a lot of respect to come to that job. Now, that we all provide for people in some kind of way. That doesn't totally let us off the hook. Whatever you do is ministry. No. There are things that we need to bring to bear on this, such as faith values, such values as justice. An example from my own life would be struggling as a sociology teacher with the issue of whether or not I require students to type their papers. Now, I was teaching at the time at a junior college. If I required students to type their papers, it would be easy for some who could afford to get a typist. It would be possible, but not too difficult, for some others who had access to a typewriter and had the skill of typing. It would be much more difficult for some who were on scholarship and were struggling to get through and had children and had other jobs in order to get through and were really right on the edge of being able to make it or not. So if I were to require typing, which would probably make some of the papers better, it would also be a real cost there. So then I have to bring in the faith value of concern for people of all economic statuses. And had to wrestle with that among other values in the situation. I should probably tell you how I came out, right?
Yes. You made up tight.
I strongly encouraged it, and what I did basically was I had people that weren't typing come and talk to me just so that I could ensure that they were responsible for creating a paper that was neat and had the same content, you know, because a lot of times people handwrite, but I all the tricks of, you know, skip lines and then you write a little bigger and wide margins and know, so people could end up writing a lot shorter and not realize it. So I just tried to ensure that the quality was there, but also gave them permission not to. So. But of course, there was a cost to that for me. I had to struggle harder. Even if I asked them to write neatly, it took me more time to grade papers and that kind of thing. So this is sort of fun to play with. It's fun to, there are a couple of ways to play with this. One way is to ask yourself, what is my primary ministry? What is my primary type of caring in this situation? So you talk about your job, and you say, perhaps my primary way of caring here is to be a critiquer, or is to be a teacher, or is to be a celebrator. What is it in your particular workplace, the workplace you were talking about yesterday? What is the primary way? And how do you do all of these other things? That's just interesting to go into each one and think about it. Now, the definitions here are brief, and there is more written on this, but the definitions are brief. You would not necessarily try to stick to the precise definitions. Use it as just a way to get started and to think of ideas. All right, how else could this be used? Some of you yesterday talked about ways that your faith was disconnected from your work. And one of the things I noticed in the small group that I was in was that a lot of times somebody would say, well, I'm disconnected when there's too much work, or I'm disconnected when this is happening. And then all of a sudden you realize that that's not just a disconnection, it's an opportunity for a connection. Did that happen with other people, where you notice the point where things don't seem to flow between your faith and your work, and yet that and right at that tough spot is right where your faith is a resource? And this is another way to see your faith as a resource around some of the problems that you might face. What are the things that are difficult about your work that you have struggled with and have not found solutions to? We did worked with a group of people once, focusing on one person's ministry. The person was in a medical profession and was on call at a particular type of doctor, was on call at a hospital that served four or five communities. And in that four or five community area with one hospital, there were four specialists of that same type. And they all took a turn. One week they would be on call at the hospital, which meant simply if there was an emergency, they would be available. Probably only meant going in once or twice a week. Well, the story turned out that with the four people that were doing that, splitting it and doing it once a week, two of them dropped out and just said, look, it's up to the hospital. I'm not going to do this volunteer work anymore. So that left two over. Well, this guy is a Christian, so he's supposed to take up the slack, right? Yes and no. I mean, he tried get the other person to do 2 weeks, and he would do 2 weeks, and the other person found that was too much, so was supposed to take up the slack and do 3 weeks. Well, it was a very difficult situation. It wasn't just twice a week that he was going into the hospital. It was the fact that whenever, for example, his wife wanted to go out on a Saturday to the store and leave the children at home, he had to say, no, you can't do that because I might have to leave to go to the hospital. So it involved his whole family. So the point was that it was really pressing the limits of what was possible. Not what was possible, but what was perhaps comfortable or acceptable to him in balance between his family and his work. But he was stuck. You know, nobody would listen to him. This was a problem. There was a need to be met. He felt a responsibility. He had the gift of this medical ability. He felt a responsibility. So we used this to brainstorm. What happens if he saw himself as a builder of community? What happens if he saw himself as a model, as a celebrator, as a teacher? And how might these different things be used to break open what seems like an impossible situation? So you can use this in a problem-solving way. What I thought we would do at the moment is check in on one or on a few different ones here, whichever you're interested in, but I'll take questions first, if there are any.
Not a question, but more a comment.
Yeah.
That what you're talking about isn't something that you do in addition to what you're doing at work. It is just how you look at what it is you're doing anyway.
That's right.
So it isn't an additional burden.
No.
I get a feeling often when I go to these kinds of workshops that people pile new things on top of what I'm doing.
Uh-huh.
When I think the intent is to look at what you're doing in your life.
Uh-huh. I'm going to pile some more stuff on you a little later.
All right.
No, that's a nice way of saying this. Other comments? All right, what I would encourage us to do is just to say, which one of these would you like to explore? Let's take 5 minutes exploring, perhaps in small groups, because we may not all want to explore the same one, but let's have a few of us explore this idea. What does it mean in our particular work situations where we were or where we are to be builders of community, for example? So if we can do this quickly, let's just shout out a couple of different ones that you would like, and then we'll form two or three groups, and I will give you a couple of, I'll give you a page to help direct the group. Which one would you like to explore? Something you're already doing or something you maybe haven't thought of much but would like to think about it? So name some.
Envisioning.
All right.
Managing.
Okay.
Routine.
Okay, and maybe one more. Okay. Envisioning, managing, making and critiquing, and critiquing. Wait a minute. Making and distributing and critiquing. Jumped ahead a little. Okay. If we can shuffle quickly, the people that called those out, actually, why don't you simply, let's pull it back in, please.
Just critique.
Any interesting findings? At least some interesting.
One finding for me is that we had critiquing, and one of the things I've found is that there's a proper time, or that time is really important with that. And there's a time for critiquing, but you have to be tactful about when you do it. So critiquing can actually have two results. It can sort of bring about more negativity, or it can actually bring the person through to some. So it can have a positive effect on the person. That's what I guess I've found.
Thank you.
We were in the making and distributing, and we came up with three different ways that we thought would be of service besides what they had given us. And one was in the schools, not so much the teaching of the regular children, but the handicapped, providing services for them, and so that they can, you know, get an education and you know, work. And then Paula is a weaver, and so she just, you know, we talked about her weaving, and she would use the colors and the thread and the materials and make something special for someone. And then I'm a cook, and I would teach nutrition and food values and whatever.
Good. All right. Well, since you mentioned the word values, I think I will go right into that. What are the values of our faith we take into the world, into the various places of the world?
Honesty.
All right, let's put some of these down. In fact, before I even write a lot, just take a minute to everybody think of a few before we get zipping along with a brainstorm here.
The human beings are of infinite
value. Just wait a second.
Oh, I'm just thinking, I'll shut it up.
Yeah.
Right, I'll write a paragraph.
Being willing to see, search for, well, truth. Okay, I guess maybe that's the word.
Search for truth.
Yeah, being willing to be, to really seek out what is really happening, I think, is not being, going through the world willing to have blinders on.
Holistic.
Oh, being intentional. Do it on purpose.
That's can be intentional about all of this, I think. But being willing to change and being willing to live with ambiguity. Almost a value of uncertainty.
You know, Barry, I mean, he's got to make it.
I was trying to put that in one word, and the words I came up with were acceptance and forbearance.
Okay. I think too often we want to have a value of having everything be sure and certain, and I think the Christian gospel says it's just the opposite.
I didn't hear what you said, Spencer.
Acceptance and forbearance, I think they fall right into that category, yeah. Living with ambiguity.
And then I think of, you have to be vulnerable again.
Courtesy?
Amen.
I'm thinking of the Scout Laws here.
That's an interesting observation. We'll come back to that in a minute.
That's important.
Enabling?
Encouraging.
And I just say something about this word enabling. That word has gotten, I think, really bad press. Because I know some people, that word is now a technical term in chemical dependency. And in the chemical dependency work, that is a negative word.
Enabling.
Because to enable is to allow someone to be dependent upon, which I think is a misuse of the word. But unfortunately, you were using it more as empowering, right? See, which is the way I would use it. And so.
How I distinguish enabling is being responsible to someone rather than responsible for them.
Mm-hmm. But see, the word, I think the roots of it is good. If you enable someone, you are helping them to become able.
One of the things I would just say about this list is that every.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. I think all of these words need to be looked at. All right? Because what somebody means by equality, what do you mean by equality? And it's nice to have a list like this, and they all sound good, or at least to most of us, most of these are going to sound good. You get to something like enabling, it's going to be different for different people. But most of these are going to sound good. But the question is not just whether we can put up this nice list of words, but what is the relationship of these to our faith? And that's where this thing about the Boy Scouts comes in. Because just because we have a whole list of words that sound appealing, are they faithful words, or what are they in the context of our faith? Like courtesy. Jesus goes in the temple and starts turning things over. Was he being courteous?
No.
But is courtesy a part of our faith, and how so?
Well, you can say that Jesus was insisting on courtesy on behalf of those who were selling and vending on in the church temple. Yeah. If you want to twist it around.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think courtesy is respect for another personality.
Okay. Well, so what I'm encouraging is that is to go a little deeper with these and to explore them. In fact, I would invite you to the work of putting together a list of principles that you live your life on. that come out of your faith. And what are, for example, 5 to 10, a dozen of the principles that are most important to you? This could be a starter list. What does it mean in your life to live for justice? What does it mean to live with a sense of interdependence? What does stewardship mean to you? Probably your own words and your own writing of that would be more valuable than going to some expert. Where are you at this point in your life? What are the unifying principles of your life based on your faith that you're trying to live? You can then prioritize then what comes first. There are plenty of things. If you took this list, I think you could start expanding on it. Love of neighbor, I mean, that's in here. But there's a lot of different angles, a lot of different ways to say things. One principle that I have on my list is love God, love neighbor. As an overriding kind of principle. Now, that might not be the way you'd want to organize yours, but it's just an interesting task to do, and to do a check-in. How am I doing with these? How do I feel about how I'm doing with different ones? So this is another angle on what it means to carry out faithfulness. What are the values of my faith? How do I celebrate how I'm living these out, and where might I want to do some changing? Questions?
I just have a comment.
Go ahead.
Before we got into small groups, we talked about being nice.
Yeah.
That's a stereotype of the Christian.
Yeah.
I like that because I feel like a lot of times we're not supposed to confront in a kind way because we're so nice. So we walk around being nice to each other and not liking each other very much.
And so I really
like to be confronted in a kind way. I appreciate it. I feel like it's a way of loving.
Yeah.
I'm working on a project right now at work that's incredibly intense and very involved. And I tend to get very excited about what I'm working on, sometimes to the exclusion of all the other things that are supposed to be going on. So I pulled two people aside and said, hey, I'm going to ask you a personal favor as a friend. Don't be nice to me. When it reaches the point that you can tell I'm not helping anymore, tell me. Don't be nice. And they promised they would be impolite and just go ahead and tell me when I'm getting in the way instead of getting the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's refreshing. Nice.
It's really wonderful to get from someone who you trust,
mm-hmm.
rather than to get broadsided from someone who is really angry at you and bitter and everything else because you may have been doing this for a long time. Like, I have the same problems. I've experienced being confronted from someone I trust and cares about me, being confronted by someone who can't stand, you know,
that
my existence. So there's a big difference.
Yeah. And some of the reason that people are try to be nice is that they're trying to refrain from dumping on others, which is healthy. That effort to be nice and be courteous and all that is sometimes very constructive. It's refraining from taking all your anger out on someone. But then there's a point at which it's no longer constructive, at which it puts up barriers between people. I think a lot of what's happening here is that we're seeing that life is not just a simple question of living one value out. It's a question of weighing how these play out in a particular situation. So the question of truth and kindness, those have to be weighed out. And what do they mean? How do they get put together? When I was preparing my notes for this morning, before I came over for breakfast, I wrote down and started going on a page, and then I made something, you know, I put something down that I didn't want there, ripped the page off, ready to throw it away. I said, oh, they're pretty concerned about ecology here. So, but also that had to be weighed, because for me to come in and see a note that doesn't have a whole lot of scribble on it and I need to look down quickly, I decided that it's all right. You know, I will waste that piece of paper because I want to have something clear because of, right? So in this case, it's okay to waste. But it really is a question of weighing values. And we do that all the time. And I think that we can get easily caught up in guilt. You know, well, I wasn't the perfect steward today. All right, so I wasn't, but I felt like, given the overriding nature of the situation, I thought something else was more important. And this kind of thing happens all the time, where we have to balance different values out.
I guess I have a question. Sometimes I hear about people asking what God's called them to, and then they describe it almost as if God is talking to them. It's like God told me to do this, or God, which my experience hasn't really been that way. So sometimes I feel like I try to, it doesn't work that way for me. So like on the question of justice, it seems like a lot of it's almost that I have to use what I've been given, or I have to think about it. So the question, I can't just go to God and ask God about it. It's, but that, I got some confusion about that, I guess. Trying to understand that, because it definitely seems to be different for me. It's not real clear a lot of times what God wants me to do. Or it seems like there's a lot of alternatives, and I don't actually hear a voice or something like that. So it seems like there has to be some other method for determining that. And a lot of times that seems to be that I have to use my mind, or I have to use the things that I've been given.
Yeah.
You sound pretty clear.
What's that?
I used to say, you sound pretty clear. To me, I mean.
God's never talked to me either. You're not alone.
Yeah.
I don't have God telling me how, which turn in the road to take when I'm driving down the road.
I listened to the PTO for quite a bit. Over and over I heard, on the way over, God told me. I'm sure he didn't tell him all the things that have come out.
People experience God differently, and I don't really know what goes on for, you know, I have a hard enough time trying to figure out how I experience God, let alone trying to understand how that happens for other people.
Sometimes God speaks to me, quote unquote, through my feelings. I feel supported, or I feel nurtured, or I feel understood. And that, to me, is a very powerful way of receiving what God's trying to tell me. And in some cases, I think, when I try and use my head, that that's probably one of the least powerful ways that I determine what God wants to do for me. When I use my head, a lot of times I screw everything up. I'm speaking for me personally, you know, but when I listen to my heart and some of the feelings, I get led in ways that my head doesn't necessarily agree with.
And we are different. I mean, you are, I agree, but that may be what works for you at this point. And for someone else, they may need to get out of some of the tugs of their feelings, which take them in this direction or that direction.
Yeah, they need to use their head more.
Yeah, so.
Could I say that, you know, maybe the balance between the heart and the head is the balancing act we have to do in order to live truthfully.
Balance is an important word. There are a number of words here that I think come to me, this question of ambiguity. We live in situations where what God wants us to do, it does often come appear to us in an ambiguous way. Could be this, could be that. How do we balance some of these different concerns? Is compromise faithful? I've heard people say Christians shouldn't compromise. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say. Yeah.
That's what they're not taking a stand on that, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you're caught in instances where there has to be compromise. I don't mean compromising principles of honesty or, you know, integrity, or such, but in some areas of life, even though you know that this is the right way, you're working with somebody else who equally thinks that this is the right way. Yeah, right. Some other way is the right way, and if you're going to get along with these people somehow or another, you might have to compromise.
What happens if they're not honest?
Well, of course, that's another story. I think honesty is very important.
Right.
Yeah.
But does that mean you leave the situation if somebody's not honest?
No, I think that's when we confront.
We tried a little different approach here recently on the contra aid. We certainly have people in our organization who are absolutely opposed to any form of contra aid, and that's really the stand of the organization. We had a meeting with our congressman over it, which we didn't tear it up, but we finally wrote a letter to the congressman explaining that on our terms, any form of aid to the Contras would increase violence, and that we simply couldn't buy that. And there was no way in the world we would compromise our principle on nonviolent intervention. But there is another part to the world, and we're not the only voice. And the reality of the situation in the Congress may not permit that as the best solution. We're looking for the solution that recognizes our equality, all people's equality, and we can't simply intervene into the situation in Nicaragua without aid. But there is another part of this country, living in this country, that says we use a democratic process. We trust the congressman to act in our best interest. He knows where we stand. Why we're that way, we're simply not going to compromise. But we are not the congressman who is finally going to have to make the decision. It's a kind of waffle on the position, but it's the best way we could come up with in that given situation to be true to the nonviolent approach, but recognize that there's no clear-cut answer, and the congressman is going to have to be there in real time, working with real people to make the best decision, recognizing the interests of all people.
Well, without getting into a long discussion on contra aid in particular, I think some of the issues around compromise are significant here. Go ahead.
When I confronted people who take this stance, well, you know, there's always a right way in a given situation. There is no room for compromise in the Christian faith. I usually say, well, okay, it's not right to lie. Is that right? And then, of course, the answer is yes. You should never lie. Well, what about the person who's hiding Jews from the Nazis in their house? The Nazis are knocking on the door and they're saying, are you hiding Jews in your house, sir?
Yeah.
Is it right to lie?
And it's nice to remember we're sinners. I mean, in spite of all of this, we go from where we are and do the best we can. Not now instantaneously become perfect, but just, hey, we're sinners. Now let's do the best we can from here on, rather than try to act absolutely.
Now, Ed asked the question whether we would leave a job if people weren't honest with us. Well, I can say to that, yes, I did. I was working as a nurse's aide in a town, and my employee wasn't honest with me. She told me that there was work and there wasn't work, and she said, oh, we'll have some. You know, and she did this, you know, constantly, you know, and the other nurses' aides and I, we would talk, you know, and we knew that she was lying, but yet, you know, there wasn't a whole lot that we could do about it at that time. And, you know, it really bothered me because I'm a very Christian person. And, you know, I couldn't stand that, you know. And so I eventually left the job, you know.
Yeah, there's a time to leave and there's a time to stay in there with people who aren't perfect and neither are we. There are no set formulas for this kind of thing. I'd like to give you another, so this is one of, you know, I gave you the 9 types of caring as one handle, one way to look at your ministry in a particular situation. Setting out a list of values is another way. And then figuring out how to apply those values and what gets weighed, what you have to let go of sometimes, that whole angle is another. Let me give you a third angle for today, which is the question of who your neighbor is. When I was working at a workshop about a year ago, I just remember this example very clearly of a woman who was working on the accounts in an oil company. And basically, I asked the question, well, who is your neighbor? And she said, well, it's, you know, I don't really have much contact with people. But I suppose it's the person in the next cubicle and a couple of people around me. So then I asked the workshop and asked her to consider that again and say, well, who is affected by your actions? Who is your neighbor? And we generated a large list of people. And find out that, in fact, she was doing a whole lot of things besides just with the one neighbor. That she realized that her boss was treating her poorly and other people poorly, and that part of the reason that was the case was that her boss's boss, who was the manager, the owner, was treating everybody poorly. And the boss's boss, the owner, would come in, would not even look at people, would simply walk past people with a superior air. And that she made a point of saying hello to him, of getting contact with him, of breaking that isolation. Because she sensed in the realm of that institution that the dynamics that were hurting her and other employees were related to what was coming down from the top person. So she was trying to have an effect on that by stating her humanness to him and also acknowledging that she sees him as a human being. So in a sense, she's saying all the employees of this organization are my neighbor. But what about a situation, a hypothetical situation, if somebody were unemployed, who had been getting oil from that company, and they were getting their account cut off? Could she do anything about that? Well, no, she doesn't make policy. She can't do anything. Well, could she do something? Well, maybe she could. Maybe she could make suggestions at the right time about what policy they have about how quickly they cut off accounts. Or if in fact, in that case, I think the company did a pretty good job in terms of allowing people who had been good customers to continue in that kind of difficult circumstance. So she could celebrate that. Our neighbors are often much more than we think they are. And I guess some of the question for you is, in one of your jobs, who is your neighbor? Now, you were joking around before about sometimes we come to these workshops and a lot gets laid on us. This can tend to lay things on, because this can tend to say, well, everybody's my neighbor. Who do I connect with? But it is a way of seeing the ripples of our connections. It is a way of seeing who we really do impact. And you can't help, when you look at the question of your neighbor, you can't help but look at the question of institutions. Because it's not just what you do interpersonally with other people inside your institution, it's what your whole institution does to the world as a result of some of those interactions. That is part of the ripple effect. So, somebody give me an example of a job that they've had that we were so we can work with a concrete example from here.
Telephone.
All right. One way to go about looking at, and I don't know the particular work that you did, but what was your institution providing? What were a couple of things the institution was providing for the outside world?
Just in communication across the country.
Okay. All right. So the purpose, the, what the institution made was communication. Now, were you part of that?
Yeah.
All right. Was everybody in the institution doing something related to that, or were some people not?
I think in a broad sense, everybody.
I would agree with that. So everybody in that, depending on how well that organization functions as a body, everybody in there is part of providing that. And the quality with which that gets provided, the way that gets provided, so that does it meet, how, you know, whose needs does it meet? Does it meet the affluent? Does it meet the needs of the poor as well? There are all kinds of questions about what your institution does that are very important. Not only in terms of what you produce, but also in terms of the quality of life for the workers themselves. So, and that's another one of these places where values have to be brought in tension. Because what, who are the neighbors of a corporation, and how do we have to weigh them? Well, there are the customers, there are the workers, who else?
Stockholders.
Stockholders.
Them.
Any others?
The, sorry, about the neighbors of the institution.
The suppliers.
Suppliers, sure.
Suppliers.
I guess I want a category that's not the customers, but the people who are adverse, may be adversely affected in some way. And I'm not quite sure what word to say with that.
Adversaries? No.
Complaintish about the service?
Well, that would, the people complaining about the service would still be customers.
Wonder,
but you might be thinking of like environmental concerns.
Well, there's a smelter in Tacoma that has customers, workers, stockholders, and suppliers. It also has literally neighbors that are getting arsenic in our backyard.
Right, okay.
So,
yeah,
all right.
Someone said competition, too. I think that's a real strong line up for
you. That whole thing, we didn't put on our list of values love of neighbor, did we? I mean, love of enemy? That whole list of values is interesting to keep reworking and seeing what didn't get put on there.
Should management be on there?
I was including that as workers, but I think it should be. I think we should put it on separately.
Separate from work. Something.
So, depending on whether you... Never mind, we get into all definitions about whether management or workers, right?
That's right.
Tom, come in and talk about whether it's a job or work or... Okay. Now, we talk about weighing an ambiguity. Isn't that all set out right here? I mean, how much weight do you give to stockholders? None? Total? How much weight do you give to customers or workers? Which is more important? How about the community? There are no set answers, but in each situation, these different sets of people are affected by decisions. And this is not just true for profit institutions. You might have to take away the stockholders for nonprofits, but there are a lot of different concerns. And we could keep adding to this list. How about the families of workers? If you create a work environment that's so stressful that demands so many overtime hours that it's taking away from the quality of family life of the workers, that's not healthy. And that happens in many places.
In the ministry.
Well, of course, what do you mean by ministry?
The formal professional ministry.
Right, okay, it happens there, among other places. So, again, the point here is a lot of weighing needs to be done.
Mommy!
I thought about this. When you're talking about all this, I thought about the whole idea. The whole idea about the you work for the good of the company. You know, and they talk about loyalty and say, well, put the company first.
You know?
And then you also think about the view that some people have of the company. Like Hillary Clinton said, what's good for General Motors is good for the country.
Yeah.
I mean, things like that.
Yeah, and what's good for the country is good for God.
Yeah.
The whole thing that Tom was talking about yesterday.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that none of that happens. When employees put the company first, they end up being self-destructive employees.
Mm.
And that destroys the company, which doesn't do any good for the country. It doesn't do any good for what God wants us to do.
There are conflicting loyalties. I mean, who is your boss when you're working for an organization? Who is your boss? I mean, what?
I am, in a sense.
All right.
Or
God?
Well, God.
Or the God within?
God, ultimately. I mean, this is the whole nature of stewardship. But the way I can see myself in that place, even in relationship to the so-called superiors, is really what determines how well we can function. You know, I mean, you talk about overload in the ministry, for instance, and I've experienced that until I came to the conclusion that, well, I've got to not take myself quite so seriously and be able to live with things I couldn't accomplish and couldn't get done,
uh-huh,
as well as the things I want to get done.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, how do you live with under a boss who wants to be a slave driver, you know, in the company, and say, well, you got to get this much done, you got to get this done, and they're there with a stopwatch, you know, like UPS, they time the workers, and they got to get so much done within a certain time. I don't know if I can live with that.
Questions of conflicting loyalty are very difficult. It's a way of touching base with a lot of things we've been doing this morning, because loyalty is often, did it get put up in our list earlier? Or before you? Loyalty often gets put up there. That's the idea of commitment to other people, being able to hang in there with other people through hard stuff.
That's a good law.
All right. But at what point is loyalty unfaithful? At what point is loyalty to a boss being unfaithful? You talked about situations with Nazis and people hiding, Jews, but at what point is loyalty unfaithful? Really, it can be, in many different situations. And how do you handle that? And how do you handle those conflicts? And where do you draw the line? To what extent do you go ahead and be loyal to the situation without even though you don't think it's the right thing to do? Do you feel like sharing what you were talking to me about it afterwards yesterday? You remember?
Yeah.
You can say no if you don't feel like sharing it.
I guess, to put it in a nutshell, I came here with a lot of pain. A lot of pain.
Yeah.
About my situation, my workplace situation. And I think pain involves, it's kind of complicated, but to put it in a nutshell, it's like how do I deal with the fact that I can only influence things so much, and after that I can't do anything to change. It's like not something that I believe in. I don't believe in the proliferation of nuclear weapons like some of the people I work with may believe. But in trying to respond in a loving way to that situation, trying to respond in a Christian way to that situation, a lot of times you get to the point where, okay, I know I don't want to, or a lot of times you get to the point where you maybe even said to the person that you're trying to help build this bond, you know, I have a lot of problems with the nuclear arms race, and maybe you've had a discussion with that. Okay, maybe you've taken that guy out to lunch and talked to him about all the implications. Maybe not. Okay, but I've been in situations like that. Then we go back after lunch and we have to talk about building the bomb again. That is an extremely painful situation for me to be in. I really don't like doing that, but it's part of my job. It causes me a lot of pain. And without getting into a long discussion of why I'm doing what I'm doing, I don't feel like I'm supposed to not be doing that right now.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. It just really hurts a lot. And I want to talk more about it later.
Yeah.
Kind of explain. How I came to this conclusion. Why I'm continuing to do what I do.
There's a real sense that you're, just in general, that you, you know, I'm not the one to judge whether you belong there. If I will say that if you do belong there, that it would be because you're having a positive influence in some other ways and helping change how people see things and what gets done, both attitudes and actions. And yet, if that's the case, for you to make that change, if that's where you are to be, there's no way that you can be there without making some compromises. Because if you didn't compromise, you'd be fired.
And there's no way I can be there without pain, too.
That's right. And I mean, you could be there without feeling pain if you stuffed it all down, which a lot of people do. But it's not without pain. And it's better to be allowing it to come up.
I guess for me, it kind of boils down to a lot of these people who are involved in these kinds of things are doing it because they're actually pursuing a worthwhile goal, and that's they believe that they're trying to protect us. And trying to protect us and themselves is not an immoral or evil thing in and of itself. That's almost, you could call it a ministry in itself. The intention of these people are, in many cases, very, very admirable intentions. And my struggle is, as a Christian, what is the most loving response that I can have to that? The easiest, the least painful thing for me to do would be to back out of it altogether and just stand back and say, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. That would be the least painful thing for me to do. Be the easiest thing for me to do. And I could find a career where I could make just as much money and have all the recognition that I want to have
if I did that. But is that what the most loving response to that person is in that situation is? Are there other responses that God wants to that than just the one of saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong? Perhaps, you know, you can say to that person, I don't agree, but I do want to show that I care about you and your situation. I respect and admire your intentions. And I know that God does too. And I want to show His love to you. I don't want to run away from the situation. It's so damn painful to be there that I don't know if I can handle that either. It's gonna be a hard time just to be able to talk about it.
I share some of your pain.
Thank you for the courage to share on the feeling level.
That's what I came here to do.
That's true, and I want to just add on that there is an incredible, and I was saying that to you last night about how there's a whole history of our lives and whatever pain was part of that history gets tapped in the present, but there's also an incredible pain in the present.
Yeah.
And there's a very real situation with nuclear bombs that you're talking about. There's very real concerns and present love and hopes for the world. And those are there too. And I'm grateful that you can share on this level, because I think by allowing the feelings to come out in this way, you allow for healing to take place and also allow for your mind to become clearer. And when you're holding on to all that, it's hard to think.
Emotions get overpowered.
Yeah.
Probably your initial syllabus for this was ministry in the defense industry per se. I have a lot more comment from folks who knew that this is what I was going to do, and I passed out the flyers to everybody. I know there's a lot of people who are in that pain who are not ready to come here. And it's those that somehow ministry needs to take place to.
I'm a bit confused about the pain that you definitely feel like what's being done is wrong, or it's, and that you're in a situation that you don't agree with ethically, and you're feeling like you're supposed to be unethical, or is it that you do agree with what's being done and see it as kind of a necessity?
You can answer this in a minute. Let me just take a stab at that. I've had a lot of pain about having worked as a junior high school teacher and tried to work on issues of racism, and done it, I think I tried to work too fast with the students. This was years ago, and I think I have a little more patience now, maybe not too much more. And I'm not sure how much good came out of it, frankly. And I think the fact that I was in that situation trying to do good, and yet I also can see places where I might have stirred things up in the wrong direction, that's very painful, right? And I was trying to do my best. And I think whatever situation we're in, our actions are not only going to be producing those wonderful apples that we saw on the image, you know, they're going to be producing the one with the worm in it as well. And to acknowledge that, and then, you know, that pain has been useful for me going on, because there may be things that I've done this weekend that I don't right now see that may be painful, that may be hurtful. It sort of doesn't really address your question, but there is, I mean, I think underneath all of us, I don't usually generalize this much, but I would say underneath all of us related to this nuclear issue is a pile of fear and anger and grief about the world. And when anybody's working close to it, if they're not feeling that stuff, they're burying it. And anybody who's not working close to it is probably the same thing. If you're removed from thinking about the relevancy of that in our lives. Ask your question again if it's not being answered.
I think the answer is yes to all three, depending on the person. I mean, some people may be in there because they believe that this is the best way to eliminate the possibility of nuclear wars, to build more bombs. Some people sincerely believe that. I personally do not.
It's an Edward Teller approach.
But there would be pain around that. I would think there'd be incredible pain around that. Then there are people like myself who don't believe in building more bombs, but also believe that there are different ways to respond in a Christian, loving way to the people who are building the bombs. And to the bomb building process, if you will. And then I didn't quite get the other category.
To me, it seemed like the pain was kind of really questioning the ethical or the outcome of the act instead of feeling like you
speak up a little.
The pain came from not feeling ethical about what you were doing, so kind of. I wasn't sure if that's what it was, or
it really hurts me to build bombs. I don't enjoy it.
Yet you're so far removed from the process of building bombs by being a supplier that builds a component that goes into the bomb. You're two steps removed. I pay taxes.
Yeah.
And I'm there in the same gang as the rest of us that pay taxes.
Actually, what I do to make that clear is I supply tooling and equipment to help in the fabrication. I don't supply the parts, I supply the tooling that makes the tools that, that the engineers use to build it. And in particular, putting on stellate coatings and protective coatings on the outside of the fuselage of the bomb. Selling the equipment that puts those coatings on.
I'd like to respond real quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that is, I design things whose job is to break things and kill people. I mean, that's my job. I help design weapon systems. I'm not comfortable with that, but I know that by my doing it, I think I am helping build things that are less likely to be used, and if used, maybe have the potential of being used, for lack of a better word, more responsibly. Being in a position is painful, but I think that's a better place to be than not being there and watching dumber weapons being built. So it's a hell of a lot of tension, because often I can't influence the process at all.
Yeah, a lot of times you have to go back to making the dumb weapon, helping somebody do that, the one that you don't believe in.
Yeah, okay, and that's what I want to say.
I think we should break.